Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This classic Radio EcoShock show from September 2009 has an interview with Jan Lundberg. It's been downloaded thousands of times. It's our third most popular program this year. We're talking with Jan Lundberg, and another argument I hear, Jan, is that the current economic crisis that we're seeing in the Western world may actually be a rebalancing. We've taken for granted that most of the world's resources come to America or Europe for consumers. I can't believe we actually bought that as a model. But now some of that is going to Asia, at least, where people in India and China get some electricity, some roads, some televisions, and maybe some more consumer goods. Is there a kind of justice as Americans use less and others get more?
Well, you could look at it that way. You could also see a poetic justice in millions of basically native peoples coming from south of the United States border to repopulate what's known as the Indian, or in your country, the First Nation populations. But when it comes to other industrializing countries using more fossil fuels and stripping their topsoil and water supplies, this is simply an unfortunate development which will not serve them in the long run, and we all suffer the climate effects of those activities. And it's also true that in the United States we lose our skills and our resources and our means of managing our lives. When we become a third world nation of service employees, and we are obtaining products from far away, from people we don't know, shipped via petroleum, this is something that reflects a very quick change in our people. It's a generation of unskilled, unprepared consumers. And so when other countries are supplying the products, and they themselves are enjoying some of these products for the class of people that can afford them, then this is just part of the whole global change that has to do with manipulating nature and stumbling upon this bounty known as petroleum. But it's coming to an end. Peak does not mean the second half of petroleum consumption is unfolding. No, it is a completely unknown world we're stepping into, and it can be very rapidly changing.
That's unbelievable. You know, car sales in China were higher than in the U.S. last year, and they're building more roadways, and I understand that Buicks are really popular there, nice big cars. It seems like oil is almost a drug that gets people high and then it kills them. It's like a disease that's spreading out over the world, I feel.
Well, sure, and it is an addiction of some kind. It's important not to focus just on petroleum, because a lot of people imagine, well, there's a clean substitute. We'll be able to continue our lives as very sophisticated scientific people, enjoying modern convenience and progress. This is something that is actually a dangerous and wrong-headed view. Because there is no real substitute for petroleum with all its flexibility and versatility. And when people are depending on petroleum for their transportation and agriculture and the plastics, this is something that is crucial to recognize and to try to plan around, but to try to extend it is folly and is a big disservice to everyone. So we have to boycott and walk away from petroleum as much as possible, and that, I think, is probably the best social movement, a strategy for rapid change, and to kick the system where it hurts and begin to use our own resources and capabilities in our own smaller communities and cheat the corporations out of being enriched.
Well, according to the latest news, the people who own the big corporations have been cheating the taxpayers, heading off to Switzerland and other places. But, you know, anybody who looks through the web or reads the papers, the headlines keep coming along, unheard of events, things that are so jaw-dropping. I could go away for 2 hours and think about that one thing, but there's 20 of them. And at the same time, I can't escape this feeling of stagnation. We aren't changing much. The government can't do much, as Katrina showed us. And the same crooks run the banks and the stock market. It feels like suspended animation, but a big storm is raging outside a solid plate glass window, and it feels so ominous to me, and I know a lot of people are worried deep down. Are you sensing that?
Well, yes, there's a bit more of that, but being basically an optimist, I think that it's liberating to view things in a stark fashion for the first time. If people can picture modern humanity as mostly slaves, with another good many of us living off the sweat of others, then it puts a different light on what's going on, instead of here's a news item on some scientific breakthrough. The corporate media serve to distract us. So if we're able to change our lives and keep moving in a direction of liberating ourselves from the thuggery of those in charge who are dressed well and speak so well, it's still oppression and exploitation for people and nature. And to reject that and to work with those who see a better way is quite pleasurable.
You've talked about several good ideas that could give us hope. Can you expand on that a little bit? What are some of the ideas that are happening on the ground in the real world that you know about?
Well, as I mentioned, when we can link people together with a local food supply, and people are cooperating and bartering and not commuting off into the distance, wrecking their health and the commute, and earning dollars to trade for things that should be free in nature anyway or produced in their community, these are trends that actually are rather hopeful. And it's all inevitable. You can lament the loss of this technological boom and all the convenience. You can say, well, I need my car. You can say, well, maybe some more oil will be discovered. But all of this is quite inevitable in the direction of a real community culture. And so you see things happening like you've heard of the 100-mile diet. Well, here in Portland, some people are practicing the 5-mile diet. There are some community gardens in former front lawns. We're trying to hook up with bike carts and sailboats, a system that will allow people to have some food security. Now, we have around, you said I was in California. I was until several months ago. I'm in Portland, Oregon nowadays. And we did demonstrate that a lot of food can be bike carted, and we got some of it delivered with sailboat as well. There is so much to integrate, so many pieces of the puzzle that are good developments and hopeful, that it will create a food security system where distribution is by appropriate technology. And there's an ethic here to really eat local. It is such a point of pride. The average restaurant is featuring local vegetables and fruits and meats whenever possible. It's just sort of a bubble in the United States.
Well, you know, you've really inspired me here, Jan, because I had the feeling that there's nothing we can do to stop the decline and the destruction, but you've also brought up the point that there's nothing we can do to stop the healing and the rearrangement that humans will make.
Yes, and it's really our true nature. We lived in a tribal communal fashion for, you can trace us back to 200,000 years roughly. And this is what we knew. We didn't know the corporate state or environmental devastation except by natural forces. And so if we have to go back, as someone might call it, at least what was known in the past was the closeness of the village community, people working for the group, and having the extended family, which, if we look around in North America, it's supposedly some great mark of independence and accomplishment for us to be so isolated and for families just to see each other on holidays.
Well, I know that's changing, and I'm working on my own family relations, and I think we're seeing people moving back in with the parents due to the economic situation or, you know, for a variety of reasons. As I say, I think there are unstoppable changes for the better coming as well. We're going to have to wrap it up there. I'm Alex Smith. You've been listening to Jan Lundberg on Radio EcoShock. I check Jan's website, culturechange.org, pretty well every day to get a sane alternative to that mainstream news. Thank you for joining us, Jan.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been great.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our opening music, When the Great Correction Comes, is from Eliza Gilkison. Well, you know, you've really inspired me here, Jan, because I had the feeling that there's nothing we can do to stop the decline and the destruction, but you've also brought up the point that there's nothing we can do to stop the healing and the rearrangement that humans will make.
Don't let me down when the great correction comes.
And we're a home going to die. Yes, we're a home going to die.
Pick a date, any date. The race is on to nail down the big crisis, the day the oceans die and humans go extinct. John Doscher is just one example of this latest blood sport, but he's in the very best company. Doscher is an 82-year-old self-taught man who laid out his doom and gloom on August 9th at the 2009 New York Green Fest. That speech was broadcast across the country by the underground hit show Unwelcome Guest. Apparently, host Lynn Gary took some flack for Doscher's untrained claims, and especially for the old man's prediction that humans should go extinct in the year 2034. Or was it 2033? It makes a big difference. Guys like this give honest doomers like myself a bad name. I'm Alex Smith, host of another depressing syndicated program, Radio EcoShock. First of all, who is John Doscher? The man doesn't even have a web page, for heaven's sake. No email. Doesn't show up on Google. Can he be real at all? Once I get over my frustration at not being able to effortlessly peg this guy as a would-be prophet, I build myself up in froth of righteous green anger. What's an amateur doing, trying to sum up the world with far-out solutions like ending all commercial fishing? Or going all the way out there, like banning new babies around the world for 20 years to prevent that overpopulation thing? Then I recall my own amateur status. Aren't we all doing the same thing? Aren't we all trying, like a million computers, to figure out the big picture, to solve our suicidal urges as a species? I've seen photos of a building in Japan the size of 10 football fields. It's entirely filled with supercomputers, all calculating our climate future. But in the end, there's no group consciousness to interpret the results. We can work in teams, and scientists do, but finally, the conclusions form in just one mind at a time, yours and mine. Some people may be brighter than others, but there is no guarantee that the most honored scientist in the world will get it better than an 82-year-old in upstate New York. We don't know where or when some unannounced mind will crack the code, will discover another valuable grain of truth. So we all try, and we should.
Can't you hear the clock is ticking? We're slipping away, away.
I'm not going to analyze John Doscher's whole speech. Get it yourself at Unwelcome Guest, Program 476, Hour 1, at radioforall.net. Doscher made me mad. Then he made me think, and I thought about it for days, and that's the sign of good radio. When I looked around, there were a collection of top experts and government advisors saying some of the same things about our limited time left on this planet, at least as we've known it. I want to focus on just two main things that Doscher said that seem outrageous. For one thing, he says overfishing leaves uneaten algae that bloom into dead zones that emit hydrogen sulfide gas that will kill off the plant and animal world. Crazy. Or is it? We'll investigate the oceans will kill us theory with Dr. Peter Ward and Dr. Boris Worm. Let's hear a bit from that John Doscher speech at the New York Green Fest.
Here's an example. In 2008, about April 23rd on WSKG TV, there was a National Geographic special, Strange Doings on Planet Earth. European fishing fleets had destroyed the fishery off Southwest Africa. They left. The fish began to return, but too slowly. The plankton, which normally, most of them by far, have their life cycles on or near the surface, weren't eaten. They died, sank to the bottom in unaccustomed tonnages, and rotted, producing huge amounts of hydrogen sulfide and methane. These were locked into the ooze by pressure. But when a low-pressure weather system went overhead, they were released in New Jersey-sized explosions. The hydrogen sulfide killed all the fish. The methane went into the atmosphere, where it stays for about a decade. Methane, molecule for molecule, is 103 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. I have to change tenses now because that process is still going on. Indeed, there seems to be no way to stop it. Then, a few weeks later, there was a news item on NPR that there are presently 200 such zones around the world, and I wish that somebody would check that out. Can we live with extinctions? With mass extinction? Can we live on a planet whose temperature has been raised 25 degrees by huge releases of methane? No, we cannot. Such a release occurred 55 million years ago. It raised the Earth's temperature 25 degrees, extinguishing at least 95% of all species. Had there been humans, they would have been extinguished very quickly. Taking care of the ecology matters. If we don't figure out a way to stop that methane release process off Southwest Africa and all those other places, very soon, we're gone. Well, couldn't we wait it out in underground cities? The answer is that it took the Earth 10 million years to evolve a new biosphere that worked. Could those facilities last 10 million years?
Probably you heard a few alarm bells going off. First of all, did the Earth's climate go up 25 degrees 55 million years ago? Well, he's talking Fahrenheit, of course. Most scientists use Celsius, which would be a lot lower. Still, I'd have to do a lot of checking before I'd believe that figure. Now we consider that a rise of 6 degrees Celsius mean global temperature should be enough to kill off most life on Earth, except at the poles and deep under the sea. But there's a lot of assumptions in Doscher's claims that scientists wouldn't make. It's a little like the chain of custody argument in legal evidence. Things don't necessarily follow in the order he gives from that one example off the coast of Africa. Yes, deoxygenated dead zones are forming in many parts of the world. But are they all simply caused by a lack of fish to eat algae? What about the pesticides and fertilizer runoff pumping the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico? Scientists think that the changing sea currents may have altered the upwelling of nutrients off the west coast, making that dead zone off of Oregon. Overfishing may be helping kill off the seas, but other factors like ocean acidification are part of the picture too. And yet, the idea that hydrogen sulfide bubbling out of the ocean, causing mass extinction of land life, well, it's not as crackpot as you'd think. Here's a small clip from my own interview with Dr. Peter Ward, whose book Under a Green Sky proposes that as a lingering nemesis from ages past.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio.
And then it seems that the ocean somehow could become poisonous, if I understand the theory in your book right. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. One of the microbial groups that does best when there's no oxygen is a form that produces hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is a great poison. It's that rotten egg smell, and the reason that we react so strongly to it and hate it so much is that it is at very small concentrations, parts per million, can kill we humans. I mean, just the tiniest whiff of this stuff, we're so sensitive to it because we know intuitively or deep in ourselves that this is poison. We cannot deal with this stuff. Stay away, stay away. And yet when we have an ocean with no oxygen at its bottom, and worse, there's no oxygen at its top, these microbes take over, and they can start producing, if they get enough nutrients, they can start producing enormous amounts of hydrogen sulfide. The hydrogen sulfide is a poison to all animals and plants. So it's not a good thing, and the microbes have produced that produce this hydrogen sulfide have left behind little biomarkers, little bits and pieces of their cell walls in these Australian rocks we looked at. We've gotten the same stuff coming from your nice Canadian rocks of the same age. And in fact, we've now found these about 10 or 13 time intervals in the past, all coinciding with rapid global warming through volcanic events.
Peter Ward has spent a lifetime trying to find the causes of five or six previous mass extinctions. His book, Under a Green Sky, explaining how the seas could kill off planetary life from one climate shift that stops the ocean currents, it didn't sell well, he told me. Where's the product spin-offs, the business plan? No money to be made knowing what the Grim Reaper looks like, especially when it turns out to be just toxic bacteria anyway. No movie rights either. Aliens or zombies sell much more popcorn. Let's move on to Doscher's claim that fish will be gone soon. His answer is to end commercial fishing all over the world. I presume he means by force, if necessary. I doubt even the U.S. Navy and Air Force could shoot down all those trawlers and those little fishing boats from who knows where, but maybe governments could hack up the docks or something. Over 1 billion people on Earth depend on fish as their major source of protein. Doscher says he once read a report from World Watch Institute saying all the fish will be dead by 2033. Sounds like a good date. I could be packed by then. But I wish I had the original report. There has been a better update on that prediction from a team of scientists representing some top ocean studies institutions. Their date for the end of commercial fishing, since there's nothing left, is 2048. Here's a quick slice from my Radio EcoShock report on dying fisheries from November 10th, 2006, still posted as a free download on my site, ecoshock.org.
The world is running out of seafood, and running out soon. Exactly 42 years from now, in the year 2048, there will be nothing left to fish in oceans. That's the precise and dire conclusion of a major new study released today by the journal Science.
Clam bakes, crab cakes, and even fish sticks could one day be a thing of the past.
Oh my God! The fish are dying!
A new report says if current trends of overfishing and pollution continue, all seafood could be wiped out in 40 years, and not just ocean life. Ecologists are also worried about fish in lakes and rivers.
That's what kills me about mass media news. Horrors never before known can be reported in those news voices, followed immediately by the trivial, as though the disappearance of fish in the sea is just another story. Personally, I thought this woman's reaction was a little more realistic.
Oh my God! I can't believe it! I had no idea!
A homophobic preacher admits hiring a gay prostitute? Now that is interesting. Everyone is clicking to find out more. The end of seafood? Not so much. These days, notice I did not say in these end times, environmental news requires a horror soundtrack with cues for when we should cry out or scream. I suppose that's part of the mission of Radio EcoShock. In the May 2003 issue of the journal Nature, two scientists from Canada's Maritime Provinces released their study, Rapid Worldwide Depletion of Predatory Fish Communities. Their research showed that 90% of all large fish, the upper tier of predators, were already gone. Fish like tuna, marlin, swordfish, sharks, cod, and halibut. All right, in late October 2006, Dr. Worm was again the lead author in a major study by 14 scientists from Canada, the United Kingdom, the United States, Panama, and Australia. Institutions like Stanford University, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and Stockholm University were participating. It is titled Impact of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services and published in the journal Science for November 3rd. The team analyzed mountains of data about fish catches from around the world, going back 50 years, and even cross-checked against historical records up to 1,000 years old. Dr. Worm couldn't believe the computer analysis, and so cross-checked the results by hand.
And I saw that the trend of collapse of seafood species projected into the future predicts that by the year 2050 there will be no more species left to fish. And I really recall the hair standing up in the back of my neck and a shiver down my spine as I watched over the students, and I thought, it's going to be in all of your lifetime, and in my lifetime too. I'm going to be old, but still I will see this happen if nothing changes, if we don't change the way we're treating ocean ecosystems.
I get into it a lot more detail in that program, so go ahead and download it when you're ready. Maybe John Doscher isn't that far off after all. Toss in the Arctic Sea, summer ice melt, and a whole bunch of non-linear or positive feedback events. Maybe the fish will be gone by 2033. Here's Doscher's solution.
So here we go. One, close all marine fisheries. Restock them with fish using special ships that can transport them alive. Net excess plankton. Use them to generate methane to be immediately burned in combined cycle cogenerative power plants, which can be up to 94% efficient. And reduce carbon emissions tremendously for an interim period until that problem of the fisheries is solved and until a shift has been made to solar and wind.
Remember Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society? He's been calling on the world's navies to start enforcing fisheries laws, as well as protecting the last of the major big species like whales, dolphins, and sharks. Too bad nobody does it. Right now, there's a Japanese trawling fleet, or a Russian one, or somebody from Europe, wiping out another Polynesian island's food supply for a generation, or trawling a seamount to death. It's happening right now, and there's nobody doing a damn thing about it. Maybe the fish will survive if we go extinct first. John Doscher suggests that could come as early as 2033. There's a nice ring to that. Should we have some kind of televised memorial planned, like Michael Jackson's? With a million-year retrospective on the big-brained apes. Or maybe just a huge celebration. Peace at last, let's party. Something bigger than the Olympics anyway as we go out. It sounds like crazy talk again, except the chief scientific advisor to the British government has just picked 2030 as a year of super crisis for the human race. Professor Sir John Beddington is the chief scientific advisor to Her Majesty's government, otherwise known as Britain. On March 19th, at an event called SDUK09, Beddington mused how converging crises will at least cripple humanity, if not kill us off, by 2030. He begins with the fact we're stacking 6 million more humans a month on this planet to hit 8 billion people by 2030. Meanwhile, as Beddington tells the BBC...
First of all, there's an increase in the demand for food. That's going to be up by about 50% by 2030. The increase in the demand for energy is going to be up by a similar amount. And the demand for fresh water, which is really very important, is going to be up by something like 30 or 40%. At the same time, there are real problems that we can't just ignore the issue of climate change. So increasing the supply of food, energy and water has got to be done at the same time without presenting problems for mitigating greenhouse gas emissions to address the climate change problem. And all that's happening in 21 years.
Beddington predicts collapsing governments, food riots, mass starvation, and unimaginable numbers of climate refugees swarming for cover. Of course, being a government man, he doesn't think that's the end. He's ruthlessly optimistic. We'll find a way to grow twice as much food with half the water as crops die in the heat. Like a Hollywood movie, we human heroes always win in the end. So there you go. The experts agree, and maybe John Doscher's right there. We're all going to die. We just don't know when. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Tune in at our website, ecoshock.org, and thanks for listening.